Evagrius' work on various tempting thoughts, we're translating the term logismos as tempting thought, although it can technically mean simply a thought or an idea, in the context of Evagrius' writings and in most of the Eastern Christian spiritual tradition, the term refers to a temptation, a thought that is inclining one towards sin. This text has been widely read and constantly used since Evagrius' day in the Christian East in its original form, although attributed to St. Nihilus, as we've described before. So it's been a very important and fundamental text in teaching people about discernment, the kind of thing that people would necessarily read if they were undertaking the work of being a spiritual director. It is a spiritual classic in the Eastern churches, and portions of it have been available in Latin versions, primarily as interpreted by John Cashin, and occasionally in small segmental translations that are found in Latin texts as well. But it's a very important text, and again, it's been even more important in the Christian East than in the West. We're going to look at two fundamental aspects of it this time. There will be a second lecture on this subject a bit later, that is to say, on this text. This time we're going to look at his biblical basis, his biblical model for the understanding of the experience of temptation. He's going to look to the example of Jesus as providing us with a way of understanding temptation and a kind of a refinement of, you might even regard it as a kind of an alternative to, but it's really a nuancing of his model of the eight tempting thoughts. The model that he will use will be to look at Jesus' temptation and to see in those three temptations offered by the devil a kind of first wave of temptations that tend to assault human beings. And he'll recommend the cure or the remedy for this, taking his lead from the Sermon on the Mount, from the sixth chapter of St. Matthew's Gospel, in which we will find recommended the practices of prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, which are, of course, now particularly associated, especially in the Roman Catholic Church, with the season of Lent. So let's look at the first description of this practice and process in chapter 1, and notice that he describes the first wave, or the first group, as it were, the first demons or temptations that one will encounter, being those of gluttony, of avarice, and of the desire for human glory. And you can see how these will correspond to Jesus' temptations in the wilderness. Gluttony, the desire to misuse the capacity for desiring food. Avarice understood in a more general sense, not only to apply to money, but to acquisitiveness, to the ownership of things, to the possessing of things, to acquisition of all kinds of different objects, to making things one's own and not letting go of them, and then human glory, wanting the praise of other human beings, rather than wanting to be in a relationship with God where one learns from God who one truly is and what one is. So he says in the second paragraph that all the other kinds of demons march behind and receive the wounded when these threes pass them along to them. So he believes that these tend to be the first and, if you will, a shock troop kinds of temptations that people experience. And he describes a kind of a successive falling in which one begins with gluttony and then falls into sexual immorality, or one first wants and desires something and then is agitated, he says, by anger, and then goes on in what I've numbered as number 3 to describe how one can then fall into sadness if one has desired and not obtained something. And he goes on to point out that pride will also follow after acquisitiveness as well. So he's suggesting a biblical base in which, if you drop down just a little further to the next paragraph, he says, this is why the devil suggested these three logismoi, these tempting thoughts to the Lord: stones should become bread, temptation to gluttony, not technically, of course, but he's seeing this as being a symbol or an analogy of our experience of temptation in this capacity of our souls. The second, when the Lord was promised that everyone would fall down and worship him. And the third, when he was told that he would suffer no harm from falling from the temple. And so for Evagrius, these are symbolic representations of the desire for misuse of gluttony, misuse of acquisitiveness, and the desire for acclaim or praise from human beings. So, having begun with a kind of a rooting in the experience of the beginnings of our Lord's own ministry, a sense of where these vices come from, and again, this is an interesting biblical rooting of his model rather than presenting the Platonic Aristotelian model of the tripartite soul as a way of understanding vice and virtue. Having introduced this biblical model, he then shifts to his second primary theme in this work, and that is that the place where one learns about temptation and learns to make spiritual progress is in noticing the kinds of images, or imprints as he puts it, that occur within the mind when one is tempted. What are the kinds of sensory concerns? How does one's sense experience manifest itself interiorly? And he says if one pays attention to this, one can not only progress in learning how to let go of and not pay attention to the things that are problematic, but one can also discover which particular temptation it is that's confronting me. I may feel agitated but uncertain as to what's going on. He says, look in your heart, look within yourself, see what kind of an image is rising up. In the second sentence of number two, he says, if the face of a person who has done me harm or insulted me appears in my mind, I recognize the approach of the tempting thought of memory of injury. Nasikakias, it's one word in Greek that I am brooding over or reflecting on injury. Or if there's a memory of possessing something or of being esteemed by others, I can recognize within my own memory, within the images that occur within my mind, I can discover, I can discern, I can learn to perceive the kind of temptation I'm struggling against, even if that's not otherwise immediately clear to me. And he points out towards the end of this that there is both a kind of desiring and a kind of indignation that are in accordance with, and there are those that are contrary to nature. The ones that are contrary to nature, the things that do not call us to desire God, and things that are of God, the things that cause us to fight against anything other than that, which is the demonic, anything other than that which leads to sin, is contrary to nature and is the result of temptation. And he says we can know this by noting within ourselves the representations that occur, but he suggests that there is also, from the angelic sources, a representation of the divine lawgiver. There can also be within us an image or an awareness of beautiful and good things. Now he'll say that ultimately, because the essence of God is unknowable by human beings, the presence of God is the only kind of experience of this sort that does not stamp an image on the mind or intellect. And it will lead him to recommend and to encourage a practice of letting go of images in prayer. But he gives, in the final sentence of number two, a recommendation that when one does this, when one can let go of noemata, of objects or concerns within the mind, then that allows one to experience what he calls a kind of luminosity, and we've seen this before, a sense of God's indwelling that is within the depths of the soul. If we look then at number three, he gives a variety of recommendations, which are the remedies against these three shock troop kinds of temptations. He points out that desire or epithumia is dealt with through fasting, vigils, and sleeping on the ground, a monastic practice of his day. And the other, indignation, thumos, one's tendency towards righteous indignation, should be tamed by patient endurance, by forgetfulness of injury, amnesikakias, letting go of brooding on past hurts, and, he says, by almsgiving. So here we begin to see this fasting, almsgiving and prayer arising, which he will then describe as coming from, and if you drop down a couple of paragraphs to the long italicized quotation from Matthew 6, here we have the recommendation precisely of these practices from the Sermon on the Mount, and Evagrius concludes, observe how the physician of souls here, through acts of mercy. That could also be translated as almsgiving, eleemosunes. The term is roughly, really exactly equivalent. Acts of mercy, which also mean giving alms. That treats our thumos, our indignation. Prayer is the way of healing, of purging our nous, our ruling capacity, the place within ourselves that is capable of contemplation, and fasting is the way of bringing under control one's epithumia, one's desire. So here Evagrius is providing, again, a biblical basis for his own model of spiritual remedies. Fasting, almsgiving, and prayer are the answer to the shock troops of gluttony, of desire for possessions and desire for fame. Now, if we drop down quite a ways, we're going to come back to some of these texts in another lecture. But if we go down now to number 18, quite a few paragraphs down, and then go down even a little further, if you wish to look at number 18, this is a very interesting kind of distinction in terms of the kinds of temptations that one undergoes, but we'll need to look in a little more detail at number 19, actually. If we drop down then to 19, he invites us to engage in a practice that really is the art of discernment. And this is one of the words that he uses, not the Latin discretio, which we'll see particularly in Cassian, but here the imperative diella, distinguish within yourself. In other words, note the details, the different aspects of how you have been tempted. When the enemy draws near to wound you, if you want to turn his sword back on him, that is to say, if you want to turn the tables on the experience of temptation, use the capacity for discernment or distinguishing, which for him consists, at least primarily here, in asking a series of questions. Look at your temptation. Be aware of what it consists in. What is it? With what external concerns, what pragmata, this is a technical term, it means the daily ordinary events, the ordinary activities of daily life, with what external concerns is it composed? What images of those things are coming into your mind? And how does it particularly afflict your innermost self, nous? What is your inner experience of how you are being attacked or attempted, or assailed? Then he says, let's use an example. Supposing that you have been tempted by avarice, you want to possess something. And in this case, let's imagine that you're being possessed by, or you're being tempted by, the desire to own gold, to possess some gold thing. He says, well, distinguish now even further between the nous, that is to say, your intellect, yourself, where this temptation has been received, and the idea of gold. Allow yourself to realize that the thing itself may not be the problem. Allow yourself to look at, to be aware of the idea, the noema of gold, and distinguish between that and the you yourself, where this idea is manifesting itself, and then realize that neither of these things is the reality of gold itself. That's something outside yourself, number three. And then realize that distinct from all of these is the passion, the tendency towards being consumed by avarice. So distinguish between the mind or the intellect, the idea of gold, the external object itself, and then the temptation which consists in the desire to possess. And then he says, ask yourself these questions. Where is the sin? Does the sinfulness that you are being tempted to lie in the mind? No, it's the mind is the image of God. That's not a bad thing. What about the gold? Well, no, the gold is a created thing. Is the idea of gold the problem? No, the image of gold isn't the issue else as well. So therefore, the cause of the sin is the fourth thing, that is to say, the passion, the temptation to misuse this, which he says is neither a naturally occurring or subsisting external concern, nor is it the idea of a concern, nor is it your incorporeal mind, but it is simply a pleasure that hates humankind, born of free will, that urges, he says, the nous to badly abuse God's creatures. So in the moment of temptation, before simply casting it away, be aware of all the different aspects of it and note the things that are good, that are from God, that are not in themselves sinful or problematic, and make sure that it is only the tendency to misuse these things which we cut ourselves off from. This is the art of discernment, or distinguishing that which afflicts us, in order that we don't repent of or turn away from the good and beautiful things that God has created. It is only, he says, the spiteful pleasure that the law of God commands us to cut off. And then as you closely examine, and this is another verb that describes his process of discernment, you will find that the tempting thought is itself destroyed by being analyzed into contemplation. So you are engaging in this act of asking questions, in looking at things as created reflections of God. Your noose is the image of God. The created thing is itself a reflection of God's glory. All that has been created is in itself, in its nature, good, even though it can be misused. You are, by this art of distinction or analysis, engaging in a contemplation of creation, that creation of which you are a part. And in the act of doing that, he says, the demon will flee from you. Your mind will be equipped by knowledge for the spiritual heights. So one engages in a kind of interior act of contemplative vision that allows one to deal with the experience of being tempted. And then he says, if you wish to go even further, then ask the inner meaning, the contemplation, he says, of this. And he asks three questions. How is it that angels and demons approach our world, but we can't approach their world? For we can't possibly make angels closer to God, and we certainly have no power to make demons more impure. And how was it that Lucifer, the morning star, was cast down to earth, and so forth? He asks us to reflect on how strange it is that there seems to be this one-way traffic between the demonic to our world, whereas we don't bother them, and how is it that the chief of the demons was himself cast down? This is a kind of a contemplation of, if you will, salvation history, a contemplation of the metaphysics of temptation, which in his mind, in Evagrius' understanding, is a way of moving from the experience of temptation to look at the tempter, at the origin of temptation itself, and that causes the tempting demons, he would say, to flee from you, because they realize that they're not confusing you. That is to say, you are recognizing that the temptation comes from them, whereas the object of temptation is itself good. So this wounds the demons and drives away all of their troops. And then finally, in the last sentence of this section, he says, let us in battle act in this way and utilize both close examination and this second method of asking spiritual questions against the unclean tempting thoughts. Now, notice what this methodology entails. It entails a rather, we would say today, sophisticated psychological awareness of the various aspects of the experience of being tempted to evil, a real desire to look at the experience and understand how only a very small part of it is evil in itself, and how one ought to be able to learn to tease out, to distinguish that which is being used by the forces that are themselves only capable of twisting and distorting, and distinguish between that reality and the matter of the temptation, which itself is good. And again, we might think on the example of St. Pelagia, of the difference between looking at someone as an object of pleasure and seeing them as a reflection of God's glory. Here, Evagrius is inviting us to do this interiorly with our own experience of temptation. And then we'll finish with number 20. He then says, whenever this happens, then you should find out why this happened. Ask yourself, once you've overcome temptation, don't stop there. Ask yourself, why was I successful? Obviously, it's the grace of God working within me, but is it because I succeeded in overcoming this temptation because it was unlikely that I was actually going to carry it out, that it was purely a fantasy and wouldn't likely have been carried out in action? Or was it because of the fact that I am learning about myself and learning to be less caught up in addiction and compulsion? As he would put it, is it because of the degree of dispassion or apatheia that we have attained? And so he's very concerned with the fact that we not only be able to overcome temptations, but understand the broader, as he puts it, battleground on which these things occur. Once we have found ourselves successful in discernment and understanding the deeper realities that lie behind the experience of spiritual struggle, then we need to ask ourselves questions about, well, okay, How am I doing overall? Why was this successful? Was it simply because I'm tired and not able to do anything as regards temptation, or I don't have the means to go out and purchase the things that I wanted, or whatever it is that kept me from it? Or is it because God really is creating within me patterns of behavior, virtues that are enabling me to, and his key would be, or his test would be, to spend more time in prayer with God? That prayer itself then becomes the thing towards which these successes lead, and themselves become an opportunity for me to engage in a dialogue with God that allows me to seek, as he puts it, from the Lord, the inner meaning of these kinds of experiences. As I said, we will return to this text in a later lecture to look at the aspects of this text that are more concerned specifically with the experience of contemplation, moving from, as it were, the battlefield to look upward to the glory of salvation history within the universe around us and the goal towards which we are moving, namely heaven and the kingdom of God.